the ticking time bomb of tension which could explode into a conflict.
In 1965, Vietnam seemed like just another foreign war. But it wasn't. It was different in many ways, and so were those who did the fighting. In World War II, the average age of the combat soldier was 26. In Vietnam, he was 19. In Vietnam, he was 19. In Vietnam, he was 19. In Vietnam, he was 19.
The heaviest fighting of the past 2 weeks continued today, 25 miles northwest of Saigon.
I wasn't really sure what was going on.
Combat soldier typically served a 12-month tour of duty, but was exposed to hostile fire almost every day.
19.
Excellent. Hello, Jay. Are you there, mate?
Can you hear me?
I can indeed. Welcome. Right. Yeah, we've had some technical issues in the studio today. Just towards the end of Julie's show, she was about to have a guest on Skype, and Skype and all the sound cards decided to turn themselves off. We have 3 sound cards in the studio, so we're trying to find out the one that was basically not working. But anyway, we managed to get it sorted out. So, how you doing then, Jay?
Well, I'm fine, but I do have a question.
Go on then.
At my end, that 19 kept getting faster and slower. Very strange.
Really? Oh, well, it seemed to be... Well, it's playing all right. Playing all right here.
Oh, so just wondering how deep the technical problems are. It sounded like it was on helium and then it was...
there's a few issues. It basically needs, since we recently moved studios, as in one room to another room, and you wouldn't think actually just moving a studio from like literally 10 feet on the other side of a wall would make so many issues, but seemingly it has. So we need to de-rig everything and then reconfigure everything. So yeah, it's quite a big job. We'll probably do that this evening actually, but anyway, welcome one and all to Inside Track. If you'd like to get in contact with us, there are a number of ways now that you can. You can go over to bookarmor.com, which is our website with Inside Track. It has all the previous shows that you can go there and listen to, plus as well some of the topics and show notes and so on. We're available on Twitter at Inside Track DJ, so if you'd like to contact us via that. I think that'll do for the time being. Right then, on with the show. How's your week been, NJ?
Slightly mixed week here. There's 2 or 3 things we can talk about the week. The first one is a politics story that you might not have caught, which I thought was very interesting.
Right, Jay, your microphone seems to be very noisy. It's got a lot of background noise on it at the moment. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you, but yeah. Is that better?
Well...
How strange.
Yeah, well, we'll see if I can sort it out at this end. You carry on, man.
Yeah, the story I saw that's come out in the last few days. Remember, we did talk about South Korea on the show.
Right, okay.
So when we spoke about South Korea, it was this deployment of this anti-missile shield called THAAD. Do you remember that?
Yes. Was it millions of pounds, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. So there's this very interesting story that's come out.
Go on then.
Well, what's happened was, when the THAAD was deployed, there were just supposedly 2 of these rocket launchers that were sent to South Korea by the American government. And what happened this week is it emerged that there are actually 6.
6.
And they had been deployed. Yes, there are 6. And the other 4 had been deployed in secret without any consultation with the South Korean government. And at the moment, they're kind of trying to work out why. The South Korean military knew, the US military knew, but no one had thought fit to tell Parliament or the President.
And whereabouts are these situated? Are the locations, if they're secret, are the locations in the public domain at all?
No. No. This story here just points out they've just handed over to this new president called Moon, and he's not happy about this. And there was already lots of opposition to the THAAD deployment, but now the South Korean people are angry all over again because deploying them in secret just sort of backs up their argument that this is fundamentally an attack on the sovereignty of their nation.
Right. How did this come out into the public domain then?
I think the president's office must have released this information because they're so angry about it. So that's the source.
Yeah, it was originally two, wasn't it? So that's and especially if they're not giving out the location of them, maybe they're preparing for something.
So I thought that was an interesting... Oh, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, obviously with the tensions ramping up with North Korea, maybe they're in preparation for something.
Yes, and it does sort of show that maybe the South Korean military is operating in close close cooperation with the US military, but for the political elite in South Korea, maybe they actually don't have much knowledge of what's really going on.
Right. That's, yeah, because they've just recently done a North, well, American has just done a test, haven't they? Basically to protect them from North Korean missiles, allegedly, obviously. They're kind of planning for the potential onslaught of nuclear weapons from North Korea. Because obviously they've been testing various weapons. Didn't they just recently do one that landed in near... was it? They called it the economic zone of Japan.
That's right. North Korea did that. And as you say, the US did their own test, but that was on US soil. Yeah. The idea being that North Korea is going to launch a missile that will somehow reach the continental US. Most of these tests by North Korea, their missiles don't really go that far. So maybe a little public relations.
Right, so first topic. We'll just mention this in passing because we covered this last week. But after you interestingly last week when we was covering the Katie Hopkins comments, the final solution comments directly after the Manchester attack, I do believe it was you that said a career-ending comment. Well, it seems that was it the next day she got sacked from LBC Radio.
Yeah, so ended one part of her career, but she's not been sacked from the Mail. I think she writes for the Mail on Sunday, so she's still working there. There was also some reaction. There was a story that came out on Press Gazette saying that the office is at LBC just erupted. The staff were jubilant when she was fired.
Well, we heard the rant from, was it James O'Brien, who worked on LBC Radio, and he was not impressed at all, was he?
No, he didn't even want to park his car in the same car park as Katie Hopkins. He seems a decent guy.
Yeah, he's been interesting, some of the comments he has, actually. So, hang on, let me just get up. So, would you like to move on to...
Well, actually, there was one more point there about Katie Hopkins, which was, although she called for genocide, basically, with her final solution comment... just a day later, she was advising Jeremy Corbyn on his choice of words. And there's this fantastic quote in her piece, sort of knocking Jeremy Corbyn, where she just points out to Jeremy Corbyn, Jeremy, words matter.
Coming from the person who had to suddenly backpedal about using final solution.
Yeah, indeed. So I did find that very amusing. So it does show that, as they say, she has just an incredible brass neck. She will refuse to go full silent. She's not one for self-reflection, so she's just carried on going. But she did, thankfully, lose her LBC platform to spread her hate.
Yes, and as far as I am aware, she's also still working for Fox News. She's a Fox News contributor, as well as Nigel Farage. Maybe that's the career that people end up going into when they leave politics or end up being, like, you know, thrown on the scrap heap of journalism.
Well, I think one problem there, isn't there, that if she's doing a talk show on LBC, they have to take calls, so it's a problem. If she's writing for the Daily Mail, there's no need to engage with the audience, actually. And if she's on Fox News again, she's kind of shielded. So I think this is the future for Katie Hopkins, a little like Theresa May, just hiding from the public.
Well, as we pointed out on the show when she was on Tucker Carlson, who's on Fox, and she was painted out, framed as the victim.
Oh, yes.
So then, Jeremy Corbyn's speech about the Manchester security attacks. There's been a lot of reaction to this, which has been quite interesting. My opinion on what he said seemed to make quite a lot of sense, blaming, not specifically, but definitely pointing as one of the contributory factors would be the foreign policy of the West generally, but in sort of specifically the UK. And yet you've got various other people coming out. I'll play a clip of... This is Tim Farron and Sir Michael, and this basically segued together.
Well, a few days ago, a young man prepared a bomb, went to a pop concert and deliberately slaughtered 22 people. Now, it seems to me that to choose to make a political point on the back of that is wrong. I disagree with Jeremy Corbyn's point, but I disagree even more strongly with his timing of making that point.
And we are prepared to do what it takes to keep this country safe. It's Mr. Corbyn who's opposed every serious piece of anti-terror legislation. He's the one who thinks you should somehow talk to terrorists. And he's even said he's not prepared to authorise RAF strikes against terrorists in the Middle East who may be preparing further attacks in Britain. That's very dangerous. Well, look what he's actually said today in a rather ill-judged speech. He's somehow implied that this attack might be our fault, might be Britain's fault, might be the fault of our foreign policy. This attack was clearly planned and carried out by a terrorist. It was the terrorist's fault, and we shouldn't get away from that. And we should remember that at every stage of his political career, Jeremy Corbyn has been soft on terrorism. He's voted against terrorism legislation. He's even said they are shouldn't be prepared to strike terrorist targets in Iraq or Syria.
Si, what do you think of that then, Jay?
Well, the first thing, we will just go into this deeper as this show unfolds, so it would be a spoiler if I went too deeply into what those Tim Farron said there. But just to warm up, there was, with regards to the timing, you know, with the nature of an attack like this, it is a political moment. So surely that is the time to step forward and state how you see things. I have more respect for Jeremy Corbyn for speaking out than I do if he just simply fell silent. So I don't really agree with Tim Farron's idea that it's crass or it's in bad taste. What can we do? How long do we have to wait until after the attack, until Tim Farron comes out, pops his head out of a hole and says, okay guys, you can carry on. There's a general election just a week away. There's no time to wait. So I thought Tim Farron's line there was just a very kind of cheap shot. The Michael Fallon one contains a whole bunch of misrepresentations that we will explore in full on this show. But to just step back a little, the basic problem for those opposing Corbyn's speech was that actually, as we'll see, he didn't really say anything that you can't find people on both sides of the political aisle saying with regards to this link between the UK's foreign policy and terror attacks on the UK. Nobody is saying, Corbyn's certainly not saying, that if the UK withdrew all of its armed forces from the Middle East tomorrow and all of its closed its bases, that the problem would go away. No one's saying that. But to kind of want to disallow even exploring the connections here, I feel that is wrong, because as you said, it's not so easy to say A plus B equals C here, but there is certainly a connection. Before the UK was so heavily involved, were we suffering these kinds of attacks all the time? I don't believe so. Also, why is it that the UK, France, Germany, Belgium, Denmark, the US, why are they all subject to these attacks, but other countries that aren't involved aren't attacked? So clearly there is some kind of link to explore. Nothing that Jeremy Corbyn said exonerated or absolved the perpetrator of responsibility for that attack, but he's just trying to situate it in a context and say, well, what could we as a government, what could we as a nation be doing differently to try and reduce the chance of a repeat of such an attack?
Well, you see, what I find interesting is that they're making... Corbyn's obviously been linked, but being an IRA sympathiser, so they're trying to tie all this... Whenever he's trying to point out something like to do with our foreign policy, the UK's foreign policy may be provoking this, these kinds of attacks in some way. He's attacked for it, and then obviously with over the last week, he's been tied to having sympathies for the IRA, when actually, when you listen to what he says... in fact, I will play a little bit of his actual speech. I've got a 3-minute clip, but I won't play the full 3 minutes.
Terrorists and their atrocious acts of cruelty and depravity will never divide us and will never prevail. They didn't in Westminster 2 months ago. They didn't when Joe Cox was murdered a year ago. They didn't in London on 7/7. And the awe-inspiring response of the people of Manchester and their inspirational acts of heroism and kindness are a living demonstration that they will fail again. These vicious and contemptible acts do cause profound pain and suffering. And among a tiny minority, they're used as an opportunity to try and turn communities against each other. So let us all be clear. The man who unleashed carnage on Manchester, targeting the young, and young women and girls in particular, is no more representative of Muslims than the murderer of Joe Cox spoke for anyone else. Young people, and especially young women, must and will be free to enjoy themselves in our free society. I've spent my political life working for peace and human rights, and to bring an end to conflict and devastating wars. That will almost always mean talking to people you profoundly disagree with. That's what conflict resolution is all about. But do not doubt my determination to take whatever action is necessary to keep our country safe and to protect our people on our streets, in our towns, our cities and at our borders.
So, yeah, you heard him say there, you know, part of conflict resolution is that you may have to sit down with people you fundamentally disagree with. And where you've got in Sir Michael Fallon now telling everyone, well, how dare you speak to anyone who's related to terrorism? I mean, we're funding and giving weapons to Saudi Arabia. So there's double standards all over this, isn't there, Jay?
There certainly is. And Jeremy Corbyn, to be fair to him too, when he's engaged in conflict resolution and talking to, as he said, people that you may profoundly disagree with, he's not been doing it like the associates of Michael Fallon as part of an economic relationship to make money from this. Surely the Conservatives should fall silent when you come to the question of consorting with some of the worst regimes on the planet. Is it more virtuous because the Tories do it simply to make money for themselves, to enrich themselves? Or are we going to have Jeremy Corbyn actually trying to lead a process towards some kind of settlement so that order can be restored and people can resume their peaceful daily lives? Tony Blair, whether we love him or loathe him, it is part of his legacy that he did help to bring considerably more peace and a more stable political order to Northern Ireland and made a huge difference to the quality of life of the people over there. So are we to condemn him because he sat down at the table and carried out the talks that led to that settlement, the Good Friday Agreement? I don't believe so. I think it's a very cheap tactic to keep bringing up the IRA. Now, is it going to be effective? For most young people, the IRA is thankfully, on the mainland, is a memory. Most people who are under 30 won't remember, personally, a large-scale IRA atrocity. What it seems to be aimed at is more middle-aged people and the older people, the older voters, to shore up Tory support, because those people do remember the IRA. Now, a friend of mine actually provided me with a comment regarding this. And he said that his parents are basically, they would be Corbyn supporters and they would vote for him because, I'll quote him, He said, essentially, my parents want rail, water and gas renationalised. They think the country is beep and getting worse. But they won't vote for Jeremy Corbyn because he's, in quotes, a terrorist sympathiser. And because of the way he may or may not negotiate the country out of the Brexit mess that was entirely a Tory creation. As you say, it's remarkable. So I think that's who it's aimed at. It's not working on the young people, but there's a section of the vote where constant repeating of the words IRA, IRA, IRA are just meant to scare you into the placing your ex for the Tory candidate.
And that seems to have worked then with your friend's parents. Didn't the government in Ireland, you're saying about privatising the water and everything, didn't they criminalise people gathering water from their own gardens and their own gutters because allegedly the government owns the water now?
Well, this is not Northern Ireland. This is the Republic of Ireland.
Ah, right, okay.
Where this happened. But this has been a long-running scandal there to do with private ownership now of the water supply, as you just pointed out. A friend of mine lives in Dublin. He has threatened to come on the show and enlighten us about this water issue.
You can't even collect water out of your own gathering for your plants. Right?
Yes. It does seem to be one of these things that's been emerging over the last decade or so. There's all kinds of measures being taken in the US to stop people gathering water on their land. So the idea now is that the government kind of owns the rainwater that falls from the sky. And I believe that was behind some of this right-wing kind of conflict that's gone on with these Bureau of Land Management in the US. So you may remember there was that whole Bundy episode.
Right, okay, explain.
There was a kind of standoff between this
farmer
called Bundy and the Federal Bureau of Land Management over the fact that in the US, the government, the federal government, just owns enormous swathes of the US and just can control whatever happens on that land. So it was about access to this land, which basically should be the commons, as we would call it, but instead it's this highly regulated bureaucratic concern. So they engage in this Waco-style standoff and attracted lots of libertarians and right-wing people to their ranch. But they were furiously demonized in the US media to discredit them, and it kind of died away again. So yes, it was a lot of that was based around this kind of access to resources that you would think no one can say, oh well, that cloud, if it starts raining, then that water's ours. But that's the way it's going.
Don't you think this idea of linking Corbyn with the IRA is a little bit like what they're trying to do with Trump, linking him to the Russians?
Well, I don't think it's as deep as that, because I believe in 1 week from now, we'll probably never hear about Jeremy Corbyn and the IRA again. So it's just purely for effect this last week. As I just to highlight how inconsistent or the double standard at work here, I was reading the right-wing blog called, do you know Guido Fawkes?
Ah, yes. I think Alan on the Word Radio, we've actually spoken to him.
Oh, okay.
On his show, yeah.
So he's a right-wing blogger. Often he just trades in kind of insider talk and scuttlebutt and scandal from Westminster. I was reading it, I must say, purely for research. And the people on his site, the commenters are truly vicious, truly vicious. Every commenter is like Katie Hopkins times 10. So if you put any kind of contrary view, they just... I made one tiny comment that I will outline, and I received about 200 hateful replies in about 30 minutes.
What did you say, for God's sake?
Well, they were fretting about the fact that there was a picture of Jeremy Corbyn with Martin McGuinness.
Ah, yes.
So it's like, oh, Jeremy Corbyn, Martin McGuinness, dead now, but, oh, terrorist. So they were furious about this, and they were running along with all their peacenik, terrorist-loving stuff. And I did point out that by the same logic, you would have to say that the Queen is a terrorist sympathiser, as the Queen shook hands very cordially with Martin McGuinness on numerous occasions in the last few years. And they did not take kindly to that.
Well, and there's also various other photographs that have surfaced with Boris Johnson. Yeah, most people have met this guy. He was in the Irish government. So of course they're going to meet this guy.
He was almost a head of state.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he was an extremely important person. Now, Martin McGuinness had his involvement in the armed struggle that went on in Ireland, but those people were not fanatics in the mold of Islamic fanatics. It was always quite clear what their aims were. Their aims were not to establish a caliphate across the Irish Sea. What they basically had always been trying to do was to reunite the island of Ireland as a single nation, the nationalist cause, which, to my mind, when I was growing up, I must declare that my family are Irish, although I was born in the UK. I never had a problem digesting the nature of their cause and actually believing that it was a valid cause. You may not support the methods used, but the actual cause was valid.
Yeah, to drive out the English, basically.
And Martin McGuinness made the transition over the years. He was a representative for Sinn Féin, and he came closer and closer into the political establishment in Northern Ireland and did help to bring peace to Northern Ireland. So regardless of his past, he went on this journey. Now, what happened was Martin McGuinness can be smeared now. He's dead, so they're coming out with this IRA nonsense. But it does remind me, actually, not the parallel is not Trump and Russia. The parallel is the way the Tories used to demonize Nelson Mandela.
Oh, well, back in the 80s, yeah, they classed him as a terrorist.
And the US still categorized Nelson Mandela as a terrorist well into the 80s. And the CIA were instrumental in the arrest of Nelson Mandela and handing him over to the South African authorities. You may not be aware of that.
I wasn't, actually.
But obviously, I'm not saying... I think people who have listened to the previous shows will understand that I'm not about to imply that Martin McGuinness was a person of the stature of Nelson Mandela. That's not my point. But he made that journey. And that is the nature of political life. That's the nature of political struggle, that people make their individual journeys. By the end of his life, the Martin McGuinness at the end of his life may not have actually been able to get along with the Martin McGuinness of 30 years previously. That's the point. That's a journey. Do we really want politicians that simply say the same thing for 50 years? That would be more like Ian Paisley, who very much said the same thing until just about the last period of his life, but he really did simply say the same thing for 30 years.
Well, so we're talking about the contradictions here, right? So we've just heard Corbyn explaining that it's generally down to foreign policy and, you know, we need to take an honest look at ourselves and see what part we're playing in it. Then we've heard Tim Farron, leader of the Lib Dems, suggesting that it was how could he say such crass comments. And we also heard from Sir Michael Fallon saying the same thing. But this was Tim Farron not so long ago.
I started by asking him whether he endorsed UK military involvement in Syria or if he had concerns.
I do not endorse it, and I am concerned about it. There are two things here, separate but both utterly vital. The first is the extent to which it is right for there to be UK military personnel active in Syria when the House of Commons explicitly voted against intervention in Syria. That appears to me at first sight to be a breach of democracy, of parliamentary procedure, and therefore a betrayal of the British people. And for David Cameron to have sanctioned that, if it is as it appears, that is quite wrong, and he will need to answer to the House and to the British people.
So there you go. You have the you have him pretty much agreeing in certain ways with Jeremy Corbyn. So there's a contradiction. Is that what MPs are about? Contradiction.
Well, it should be that way. And if we're going to talk about the contradiction, what Tim Farron said there just sounded like he was speaking from conviction, and he was unhappy that Parliament had voted against British involvement, and yet, a little like the South Korea with their THAAD, magically, the British become involved anyway. I believe it may have even been that British pilots were flying in American planes. That's how they were taking part.
It's... yeah. I don't know. I get lost for words sometimes when you see these MPs contradicting themselves like this, and you think, how can I take... You seriously, today you'll say one thing, next week when it suits you'll say something else.
Well, we can talk there about Jeremy Corbyn, which is you can actually find, not that he's repeating exactly the same thing each time, but his values haven't changed, because why should they? His values do appear, to me at least. Michael Fallon might like to say he votes against all the anti-terror legislation. But as Jeremy Corbyn said himself, what he's been pursuing is peace and human rights and conflict resolution. So to Michael Fallon, that's just distasteful on its face, and he portrays that as being soft on terror. You have to tell me which is going to work in the long term, Britain being the world's second largest supplier of arms to the rest of the world, or are we going to take a different path? I don't believe, as a small nation about to leave the European Union, that it can be Britain's role in the world is simply to be its armourer. Jeremy Corbyn stands for something different. Michael Fallon doesn't approve. But the values, I think, have struck a chord with the British people. There was nothing actually in his speech, and you just played that clip there, Dave. Nothing in the tone of that is objectionable. Nothing. So they feigned outrage, and Tim Farron had to latch on and try and find something. As you say, they're happy to contradict themselves all the time, but the problem is, it used to be that the public memory was very sure. We always had this idea, politicians bemoaning, bewailing the goldfish-style memory that the public have. Actually, now what politicians are not so happy about is social media and YouTube makes it quite easy to go back and see and check what these people are saying today. Is it consistent with what they were saying yesterday, a month ago, 6 months ago, 6 years ago? And as you just showed with your clip, Tim Farron was making far more sense a year or two ago than he is today.
Well, okay, so to continue on this theme, there's a great clip of Sir Michael Fallon having an opinion on something that he didn't. He got caught out of, you know this clip, obviously, Jay, you're familiar with it. It is stunning. And here we go.
The attack on the Twin Towers, that was well before the Iraq war. So there's no correlation here between foreign policy and this appalling act of terrorism. And that's where Jeremy Corbyn has gone wrong.
Isn't it possible that things like the Iraq war did not create the problem of murderous Islamic fundamentalists? But the war has unquestionably sharpened the resentments felt by such people in this country and given them a new pretext.
Well, I don't think you should allow pretexts for people who blow up innocent children.
Because those are actually the words of Boris Johnson, the Foreign Secretary.
Well, they're not entitled to excuses. You know, this was an act of murder, and of callous murder at that, taking the lives of innocent civilians.
What I just put to you was not Jeremy Corbyn, it was Boris Johnson.
Well, what were the words you were quoting?
The Iraq war did not create the problem of murderous Islamic fundamentalists, though the war has unquestionably sharpened the resentments felt by such people in this country and given them a new pretext. He goes on to say the Iraq war did not introduce the poison into our bloodstream, but yes, the war did help to potentiate that poison. That's exactly the same as what Jeremy Corbyn is saying now.
No, I think it's more is what he's saying that of what I've said. He said you can't use attacks like this to explain away terrorism.
Actually, on the contrary, he said, it is difficult to deny that they have a point, the Told You So Brigade.
Well, I don't agree with that.
So Boris Johnson, the Foreign Secretary, is wrong?
Well, I'd have to see the words that you're trying to quote to me. I don't have them in front of me.
Well, I've just told you them.
Well, I'll have to look at them. What I don't accept is that you can explain away terrorist attacks in this country by simply saying there's been an issue with our foreign policy over the last few years.
That's stunning right there. It instantly assumes it's Corbyn's words without realising it's probably the chap who sits next to him at the cabinet table in the government, who's the foreign minister.
That should be a career-ending trap that he just fell into.
It won't be. No, he'll carry on.
The interesting thing there, the Michael Fallon voice is a difficult instrument to appreciate. It's awful. But if we just look at the words he said, one thing he said that was demonstrably false, that was that he said the 9/11 attacks happened before the 2003 Iraq war. Therefore, they were not inspired by that war. Well, it's half true, isn't it? The first Iraq war happened in 1991, and the first attack on the World Trade Center happened in 1993. It was an enormous car bomb that was parked in the basement, and because the terrorists put the car in the wrong place, or the truck, it didn't actually bring the towers down. So that was straight after the first Gulf War. And 2001, yes, technically it was before the second round, but as I say, no, there's a clear link between intervention in Iraq and the attacks, the two attacks on the World Trade Center, so just factually wrong.
When you're talking about that chap that did the 1993 World Trade Center bomb, the truck bomb. It was in the car park underneath, wasn't it, from all accounts. Wasn't that the chap that had recorded the phone calls that he was in cahoots with the CIA? And it was the CIA that had basically armed him with the bomb.
Yeah, I can't recall it from memory, but on a similar theme to that, Dave, if people read the book that I talked about on a previous show, it was called Secrets of the Kingdom. I did say the wrong title, unfortunately, on the show. I said House of Saud, which is another book about the Saudi regime. This one's called Secrets of the Kingdom. It's by Jared Posner. Now, he opens that book by talking about, you're going to appreciate what went on here. This was a Zubaydah guy.
Right, yeah.
He was this terrorist that was caught. He was supposed to be responsible for 9/11. So he was caught. Now, what happened was the Americans came up with a great wheeze. They thought they would pose as Saudi intelligence officers. So they got a couple of their men to go and pose as Saudi intelligence officers to interview him. So a little bit of false flag chicanery. So they went in and they started to speak to him. What was the first thing Zubaydah said? The first thing he said was a stream of telephone numbers of important senior officials inside the Saudi regime, including a prince and people very close to the top of the political structure. So you have to be careful with your subterfuge. They found out something there they really didn't want to know. So Posner looks into the names that were quoted, and you may not be aware of this, but what happened was within about 2 years of those names being spoken in that room, all of the people on that list of names, they all died in various accidents. They were all silenced, basically.
Yeah, well, that's not so much of a shocker there. We're having.
Yeah, so it won't go. Oh, sorry, Dave. So it won't go too deep into that, but there's always more to say, and it all points back to the same thing, that Jeremy Corbyn is the least of our worries when it comes to what facilitates Islamic terrorism. He's a non-entity, really. He's not a player in the game. The Conservative Party has people in their government and sat on their benches, and there are officials working in Whitehall and our defence contractors. They are players. They are part of this game.
Well, okay, so this is where Andrew Marr tries to drag up the IRA connection with Corbyn and tries to drag Diane Abbott into it. She has an interesting way of trying to get out of the conversation.
You yourself said that it would be a defeat for the British state would be a great liberation, a great move forward at that period of time. Do you regret your support for the IRA right back in the 80s?
That particular quote you're referring to comes from a now defunct left newspaper, and it had, as well as this.
But you said it, didn't you?
No, but what I'm saying to you is this. It was 34 years ago. I had a rather splendid afro at the time. I don't have the same hairstyle, and I don't have the same views. It is 34 years on. The hairstyle has gone, and some of the views have gone.
So you no longer. You regret the fact of what you said then about the IRA?
The hairstyle has gone, the views have gone. We've all moved on in 34 years, haven't you, Andrew?
We've all moved on. I'm just wondering, do you regret what you said about the IRA at the height of the bombing?
What specifically do you want me to regret?
I can read the quote for you if I can find it here. Basically what you said was that a defeat of the IRA would be devastating for the British people, and it was a defeat for the British state was a good thing, you said, at the time when the IRA was attacking the British state. And you said that the reason for the violence was entirely caused by the British presence in Northern Ireland. I'm saying, do you think those statements now are wrong?
It was 34 years ago. I've moved on.
You've moved on. All right. I've got the quote here, finally. You said, the Ireland is our struggle. Every defeat of the British state is a victory for all of us. A defeat in Northern Ireland would be a defeat indeed, was the quote.
34 years ago, and I've moved on.
Okay.
And she has a different hairstyle now. So that shows you how much she's moved on.
She's still black, though, so she hasn't moved on fully.
Well, I mean, what she's saying there, the point she's making about the British state is interesting. Andrew Marr is coming from the point of view that to run down of the British state would be to run down everyone in Britain. But I would class those as two separate. The British state are the ones that, you know, that's a different entity to the rest of us. So when the British state has a defeat, yeah, actually, could cause a ripple effect that the rest of us could actually benefit from in some way. So I do kind of see where she's coming from. It's interesting that she doesn't flatly deny it. She doesn't basically go back on her word. She steps around answering the question, basically. I thought that was interesting.
Well, what you say there, Dave, I think is one of the crucial insights that we've offered on this show again and again, which is when we hear words like national interest or the British state, that we're not to think that it means all 60 million of us living in the UK. Well, me, I'm living far away. But you're right to point it out. And Andrew Marr almost impugns the kind of patriotism there of Diane Abbott. I'm surprised he didn't come out with one of those lines like Keith Baz to Alan Rusbridger. Do you love your country? You know, the intelligence services.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the intelligence committee. We did play that clip. Yeah, I also would say that Diane Abbott was right to stand her ground there, because he was asking a question, do you regret that statement? But he wasn't indicating, does he mean, does she regret making it at the time? Or does she regret now having made the statement? And I think the reason Diane Abbott was staying mum on that was because actually, no, why should you? If you're working from your values, your convictions, why should you have to regret what you said while espousing those values, espousing those pushing those convictions? History can take a turn and it can make you look foolish. So here we're dealing with another contradiction, if we're sort of picking up on them. But the contradiction here is not being made just simply for short-term political gain. To go back 34 years and try and hold someone to their words. You know, when 34 years ago, I really liked jam sandwiches, but I don't like them now. It's not to make a trivial point. It's just such a long span of time that, again, Diane Abbott has gone on a journey. She was younger. She was perhaps more idealistic. She didn't speak so, measure her words so carefully. Andrew Marr was rather horrible, the way he span out the quote, you know, at length to try and aim for maximum embarrassment. It really wasn't very pleasant journalism. But I think she came through it okay, actually. And most people will think, hopefully, about the fact that 3+ decades is a significant amount of time in anyone's life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you're right to say that when you say it, you explain that people go on a journey. That's generally what it is. So 34 years is a hell of a amount of time. And I think most people, no matter what age you are, with me, if I was to go back 34 years, I'd probably be a teenager. So maybe it's a little bit different. If I was my mother's age at 75, going back 34 years, I wouldn't have been a teenager. I may have a different perspective on things. But I think no matter what age it happens, 34 years is an amount of time where most people may not so much think differently, but choose differently whether to say it.
I think most of us would shake our heads, wouldn't we, in disbelief, if we could see our younger selves and the things that we were doing and the things we cared about and the things we were not doing and that we didn't care about. We'd think, oh, you're going completely the wrong direction. You're doing completely the wrong thing. What are you doing? You're such an idiot. If we had that benefit of hindsight to look at what we were up to in our lives. And also, when you just wind the clock forward again, if I went back and visited my younger self and said, you know, hello, Jason, 20 years from now, you'll be living in Asia. You'll be married to a Taiwanese. You know, I think, get out of here. That's all nonsense. What are you talking about? I've never even been out of the UK. I don't have a passport. But all those things come to pass over time. I think also you have to remember that at the time Diane Abbott and Jeremy Corbyn were very enthusiastic about the Irish cause, it was on the left, the nature of leftist politics then, there were a number of causes tied together. And these were the causes of the Palestinians, the cause against apartheid in South Africa, and the cause of Irish republicanism. So they were basically de rigueur on the left. You know, you had to be behind those causes. So there's a long track record of Corbyn and Diana Abbott speaking about those issues because, yes, those were the causes of the time. Now, on the subject of apartheid, Jeremy Corbyn doesn't keep digging out Tory ministers' comments or trips to South Africa before apartheid ended. He doesn't keep talking about the Conservative Party's active resistance to the boycott of South Africa. And the media, if he started to try and do that, I think we'd see in short order, they would say, well, this is completely a distraction, Jeremy. It's a red herring. You know, it's long ago. Yeah. Well, as you rightly point out, all this IRA stuff is long, long ago, but they don't want to let up because they feel that it's getting some kind of traction. I did read you that that quote from my friend about how his parents seem to have turned against Corbyn on the basis of this IRA thing. So it certainly cost Corbyn two votes in that case.
So, yeah, it's an effective way of basically smearing somebody's name, isn't it? And like you say, if you say it regularly enough, gets into the social consciousness to a certain extent, and then people start thinking, oh, well, there's no smoke without fire, even if people like some Michael Fallon misquote and are not 100% accurate, but on purpose, maybe. People will walk away with the wrong information, but believe it. So, yeah.
There's also the fact that there's an entire industry devoted simply to creating smoke.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That would be my...
So this idea there's no smoke without fire. Well, actually there is, because some people like Linton Crosby and these kinds of media consultants, they basically produce smoke. That is their role.
Well, they had yesterday, just as a little caveat, there was a BBC article that was suggesting that they've now come up with a... You've got the fake news. Now there's another term being propagated by the BBC yesterday, junk news. And they said the main difference between junk news is that this is primarily on social media. And it's junk news. So this, I suppose these would be like the clickbaits that we see, you know, sensational headlines, and then you'll click on the story. You'll go to a website that will be counting visits for their advertisers, but actually the story is complete nonsense. But they're trying to tie fake news, and they've done studies during this election that it seems that but the BBC, mainstream media, are winning the info war. Right? They actually did a survey yesterday where they suggested between those of us who may be trying to spread some, not alternative news, but news, as far as I'm concerned, right, and not nonsense, as what sometimes the BBC put out, more often than not. Well, according to this study, the likes of the BBC and Sky are winning the info war. They are being able to put out more information than anyone else who, and then of course they call it alternative facts.
Oh dear. We've gone through this so many times, haven't we?
Yeah.
They're in a position of power, but that power is waning because of the rise of social media and the rise of alternative news sources. But they are still in a position of power. And what they're trying to do as their power wanes, they're trying to discredit the rising phenomenon of people sharing on social media. So this is part of The Guardian putting pressure on Facebook to change the moderation policies, or the government putting pressure on Facebook to filter out fake news, and then the BBC, all this kind of media awareness. It's as if they're trying to teach us how to think now. What it all comes down to is they just don't want public trust to leech away from Sky News and the BBC. That is just because it's part of their, basically it's their social capital. If they're not believed, if they're ridiculed, if they're mocked, the BBC and Sky News will kind of fade. Their relevance will fade. I believe their relevance is already fading. But as you say, it's just this like thrashing around, lashing out at everything.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know, you sometimes lose faith. With the polls that are coming out currently, where Corbyn is catching up with Theresa May, have you seen any of these polls that are saying that this lead of Theresa May's is dwindling? Especially after last night's fiasco, where they had seven people from seven parties all sitting here discussing. And of course, Jeremy Corbyn played a blinder, actually. He had originally said, I'm not going to attend this, leaders' dialogue unless Theresa May's there. And because Theresa May's not really interested in talking to the general public, it seems, he had said, well, I'm not going to go if Theresa May don't go. But then at the last minute yesterday, he said, well, no, I'm going to go. I'm going to go, and I throw the gauntlet down to Theresa May that she needs to attend. Now, she didn't attend, and it was Amber Rudd who, from all accounts, literally 2 days before last night, had lost one of her parents. And so now certain people are coming out saying, how cold is Theresa May making her colleague, who has just recently suffered a loss of one of, you know, one of their parents, to make her stand on the TV. And it was funny because after the event, the leaders' debate, I think it was on BBC One, it turned out that there was one of the BBC Talking Head journalists going, "Yes, well, the reason why Amber Rudd was getting it from all sides because she's obviously a member of the party that's in control at the moment." The fact that she was coming out with complete nonsense, and obviously, I mean, she did a blinder job if that's what she was dealing with, you know, going through the loss of a parent while doing that. I mean, that's quite a strong woman right there. But it does show what kind of person Theresa May is.
Well, you read my mind there by moving on to the polls, because for the BBC and Sky News and some sections of the establishment media, the mainstream media, again, what's demonstrating that their tactics, and it really has been for the last 18 months, perhaps, there was this consistent, this sustained onslaught about Jeremy Corbyn. You know, the first thing that you're always told about him was he's unelectable. That was the very first thing that they would repeat, you know, constantly. He's unelectable.
I've heard from so many people, exactly that line. Oh, he's unelectable.
Yeah, you were supposed to dismiss him out of hand. The whole idea was that he would never get a hearing. So they had the unelectable thing, and that seemed to have stuck quite well. But what's happening now, the BBC and the mainstream media, they're finding out, kind of to their horror, that the polls demonstrate you can have your media bias, you can have your BBC journalists continually shilling for the Conservative Party, and yet still, people are just not obeying it. It is like They Live, that movie, isn't it? The sci-fi movie. They're trying to make people simply obey. And it doesn't work because, for whatever reason, people have got the sunglasses on that allows them to see the nature of the game these days. Social media is just lifting the scales from people's eyes. So the polls are very interesting. One, it's difficult to believe them or trust them because they're moving around, swinging around so wildly. And some polling, of course, is deliberate. It's designed to push people's voting intentions in one way or another, so it's actually part of the campaigning toolbox. But The Independent has a story today saying that in London, Jeremy Corbyn is now threatening all those Tory London MPs because support for him now in London is, his personal approval rating is higher than Theresa May. It would be an absolute disaster. We can come on to Amber Rudd in a moment, but I'm hoping maybe Corbyn's not going to form the next government, but there should be plenty of ashen-faced Tories after this, on the night of the election results coming in, because Theresa May has really been absolutely dire. So now, the thing about go on.
All I was going to suggest was, like, there's the car crash interview. Was it what radio? Was it Radio 4? The Woman's Hour. He's at some Radio 4, I believe, Jeremy Corbyn, where he stumbled over some figures. And I had someone, when I turned up to the studio today, someone said to me, "Have you seen the people attending the speeches of Jeremy Corbyn? These are running into the thousands of people at each event." I mean, it's phenomenal what kind of seems to be going on there, but obviously none of it's being broadcast on the news generally. Recently, a little bit, every now and again. But nothing compared to what's been going on with the Theresa May campaign. that seems to be like Rent-A-Crowd turning up in a minibus, isn't it?
Well, there's two things there. You read my mind again, because there's a link between Amber Rudd and the Woman's Hour interview.
Okay.
And the link. Well, the link would be the nature of their the money involved with both of those high-profile Tories. Firstly, the BBC chose a very high-profile Tory, Emma Barnett, to interview Jeremy Corbyn. And she writes for The Telegraph, and she's basically outed as a Tory. Now, the interesting thing about her, I don't know if you're aware of this, but she received a very expensive private school education in Manchester.
Oh, I didn't.
Do you know the source of the monies that were used to pay for her education may interest you?
Oh, I did see an article with her father was a criminal or something. Was that right? Was it her father?
Yes, her father ran a chain of massage parlours in Manchester and was involved in human trafficking. And the money that paid for her privileged education came from they were immoral earnings, and her father later went to prison. So that's very interesting that she now parades herself as this kind of very respectable journalist. Amber Rudd, similarly, you may remember that Amber Rudd did not mention her financial dealings, and these actually came out through a leak.
Right, okay, what financial dealings were these then?
Well, what happened was she organised, Craig Murray has got a post about this, and she organised this company called Monticello PLC, and she was the director. And hundreds of investors put money in, and the company didn't appear to do anything except pay its directors. And at Company's House, it says it then went bankrupt with 1.2 million of debts and no important assets. What he thinks there was some kind of share ramping scheme to rip off investors. So that was one way Amber Rudd made some money. She was also found, like I say, to not have declared all of her interests on the members' register in Parliament. Of course, being an MP, she could just put that down to an oversight and move on. Her father, who just passed away, he'd been struck off as a company director because he'd been misusing the assets of an investment company, Greenbank Trust, for his personal benefit. So we've got two very wealthy Tories there, both of them. Their actual wealth is not based on anything like hard work. They both derive from very dubious sources, but they've risen quite high in public life in the UK. One was there on the TV, taking Theresa May's place, and the other one was there trying to stitch up Jeremy Corbyn on Woman's Hour. I don't know if you're going to play a section of that.
I can.
Let me understand then, how much will it cost to provide unmeans-tested childcare for 1.3 million children?
It will cost... it will obviously cost a lot to do so. We accept that.
I presume you have the figures.
Yes, I do. It does cost a lot to do it. The point I'm trying to make is that we're making it universal so that we are in a position to make sure that every child gets it, and those that can... at the moment get free places will continue to get them. Those that have to pay won't, and we'll collect the money through taxation, mainly through corporate taxation.
So how much will it cost?
I'll give you the figure in a moment.
You don't know it? You're logging into your iPad here. You've announced a major policy and you don't know how much it will cost?
Can I give you the exact figure in a moment?
Is this not exactly the issue with people and the Labour Party, which came up under Gordon Brown, that we cannot trust you with our money?
Not at all. All our...
You don't know the figure.
All of our manifesto is fully costed and examined. And,
but you're holding a manifesto, you're flicking through it, you've got an iPad there, you've had a phone call while we're in here, and you don't know how much it's going to cost.
Can we come back to that in a moment?
What, when you've looked it up?
Well, look...
My point is, it's quite troubling. This is a policy you're launching today, Mr Corbyn, and you don't know how much it's going to cost. It hardly inspires the voters.
Oh, you can hear in her voice, she's loving that.
Yeah, she's a high Tory. That was not objective journalism by any stretch, was it? So she was basically just rubbing in the thing the whole time there. It's misleading to believe that temporary, what do we call them, brain farts, or just not being able to recall a figure off the top of your head. Firstly, that's not how government is done anyway, so it's not really the way things work. Jeremy Corbyn didn't sit up at a desk with a pencil and write the entire manifesto himself. It's just naive on its face to kind of portray things in that way. Of course, we all enjoy the schadenfreude, you know, enjoying watching other people squirm and be uncomfortable, especially if it's someone that you don't particularly like. Michael Fallon, you played that clip. Well, it was wonderful to hear him being so pompous sounding and then just wander completely into that trap that had been set for him and then flounder around. Well, I have to look at it. Well, I just told you what he said, you know. So again, maybe for those that don't like Jeremy Corbyn, it gives them some grim pleasure to listen to that, but I don't think it's that meaningful. It's more interesting to me that the BBC selected someone very right wing in order to grill Corbyn on Woman's Hour.
You see, we've played a few politicians, right, in the clips that we've just done, that have basically put their foot in it from what they say. And I managed to find a clip of Tim, our friend Tim Farron, Lib Dem leader. He doesn't even have to say anything for people to seemingly laugh.
Lastly, Mr. Tim Farron!
The Prime Minister...
Order! The rights of my order! However irritating the Honourable Gentleman...
may be to government backbenchers, he has a right to be heard, and he will be heard. Mr. Tim Farron.
I am fantastically grateful to you, Mr. Speaker.
Yeah, there you go.
Please, sir, can I have another?
There's an even better clip if we're going to talk about the nature of being able to make people laugh or astonish people without saying anything. I didn't send it to you to use on the show because it doesn't work on the radio. Right. But there's an astonishing video of a White House spokesperson being asked a question about U.S. Views on democracy in Saudi Arabia. You haven't happened to
I've
see
got
this
it.
Clip, have you?
I have.
In fact, I have it. Hang on. There we go.
I actually have it.
You were over there. The secretary criticised the conduct of the Iranian elections and Iran's record on democracy. He did so standing next to Saudi officials. How do you characterise Saudi Arabia's commitment to democracy? And does the administration believe that democracy is a buffer, a barrier, or against extremism?
I think what we'd say is that
unbelievable meeting, amount of time to pause.
We were able to make significant progress with Saudi and GCC partners in both making a strong statement against extremism and also.
Yeah, I mean that's.
Well, I'm glad you played that. I do have a word picture for the listeners, okay. If you haven't seen that clip. I would recommend going to view it. And that is, the astonishing thing is not just the pause, but what happens to the man's face.
Yeah.
His brain freezes a couple of times as he's trying to process what the question he's been asked. In astonishing fashion, the only thing I can compare it to is, have you seen the movie Awakenings with Robin Williams?
I've not, actually.
Well, in that movie, he plays Oliver Sacks, and Robert De Niro stars in that, and it's about the use of dopamine to revive people with Alzheimer's. So they're given these injections, and then they start moving again. Yeah, at that moment when his face was frozen, it looked seriously as if Robin Williams was going to walk on in a white cone and give him a dopamine injection to get him moving again. It was that severe. It was catatonia.
I aim to come by that yesterday, and I was like, what? What? And it's just unbelievable, isn't it? Obviously, we recently said about Saudi Arabia being on the Human Rights Committee advising on human rights, which is, you know, just diametrically opposed to what they do generally.
Well, they're certainly experts on human rights.
Or lack of.
It wouldn't have surprised me. Have you seen the movie Scanners, to throw in another movie reference?
Oh, indeed.
It would not have surprised me if his head had simply exploded after 20 seconds.
Michael Ironside is the actor in that one.
Yeah, yeah. So anyone who's seen Scanners, the David Cronenberg movie, does look as if he's simply the pressure's too much and boom, it goes.
That is great. Right, so what's the... where are we off to now? What's the next topic, Jane?
Oh, don't test me.
What's that, sorry?
I said, don't test me.
Oh,
you're
no.
You're the host, so
okay. Well, okay, so we were just recently with the Theresa May. Was it last week we mentioned about there was a particular paragraph towards the end of the manifesto, the Tory manifesto, that suggested that... It was like a comment where it said, there are people amongst us who think that regulating the internet is a bad idea. We disagree. And then someone phoned up the Tory campaign and pushed further on some kind of meat on the bones of this particular statement. And they turned around and said, yeah, we plan on regulating the internet. We have to protect children. We have to protect people from bullying. We have to get rid of the fake news and all these other things. It also falls in perfectly in line with the EU regulation that's due to come out. And now we've got various people suggesting, linked to the Manchester attack last week, that the way... I mean, this is just absolute nonsense. Let's completely omit for the moment. He went to Syria. He went to Libya. Right? Well, let's just overlook that for a minute. We're not supposed to know that information. The whole point he got radicalised is because he had access to the internet. And now we need to clamp down on the internet. What do you think about that, Jay?
Well, I believe we're moving into the kind of meat and bones of the show, because we did run that reaction to Jeremy Corbyn's speech in the wake of those terror attacks, and Michael Fallon did make his comments there. And as you point out, what we've learned in the week since. Now, last week, right after the attacks, I said on the personal level, I wasn't that interested in the attacker. You know, these are usually just pieces of human garbage that have got useful idiots, as you like to call them, who have been pointed in the direction to go and then wound up like a clockwork toy and then set on their way. What we've learned in the week since is actually very interesting, though, and deeply complicates the picture of this attack. It's interesting that on the internet there's been some kind of conspiracy theory accounts for the attack. I don't know if you wanted to turn our attention to those first and then come on to kind of the real connections rather than the conspiracy ones.
Okay, yeah, all right. So we'll... There's a couple of conspiracy ones that I've managed to find. This will be the first one. It'll become self-evident what the conspiracy is.
Because there's false flag written all over it. This conclusion becomes quite obvious after you realise that the Manchester police tweeted several messages hours prior to the alleged attack, warning people about a quote-unquote controlled explosion with non-suspicious items being conducted in the vicinities of Manchester Arena. If that fact alone does not suffice to open your eyes about yet another government-sponsored false flag attack, the immediate suspension of UK general elections, benefiting nobody else other than Theresa May's political associates, might give you more clues. Although I confess I'm not entirely sure that that's the reason, because I'm having a very hard time believing that the fact that the alleged suicide bomber has the same name of Saudi terrorist sponsor King Salman is just a coincidence.
I'll leave it there because, you know, it's not really giving you any real groundbreaking research, is it? It's all pie in the sky, my opinion, I think it could be this. Right? So that's one.
Yes. Sorry.
No, that's all right, Jay. If you've got an opinion on it, go for it.
No, you carry on talking about it.
Okay, so there's that one, right? And, you know, these people have such a conviction of their opinion that they have to use a computer voice to, you know, to articulate it. But we'll just move on from that one. Now, this is an actual individual. She's a YouTube user. Highly questionable, I believe her name is. What's interesting is I've always led to believe when you go into a thought process where you're going to ask yourself questions, at some point you must come to a conclusion, and whatever that conclusion would be, you would act upon it or whatever. This YouTube user seems to just ask endless questions and never seem to go anywhere.
Okay, well, I really just wanted to do a really quick rundown on this. So my initial thoughts are maybe this is a false flag attack, perhaps. I just saw this article actually that said that the suicide bomber. So if it was a suicide bomber, I'm almost more inclined to think that maybe this was a false flag attack. Terrorism is used a lot of times to promote a lot, taking away rights, basically. So in France, after that stabbing in France, or excuse me, I can't remember what the attack was. After whatever that attack was in France not too long ago, I said to my fiance that they are going to use this as a reason for more policing and stricter laws and less rights. And sure enough, they actually put Paris in a police state for a while. And so I'll be curious to see what happens with Manchester after this goes down, to see if they actually do enforce more of a police type state with it.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously there's a few problems with what she's saying right there. But what's your thoughts, Joe?
Well, my thoughts on the first one, as you said, he used... I do have that software that produces the anonymous voice, so I do sympathise with him for that, but I only use it for recreational purposes.
Oh, yeah. How can you use that for on your music, I suppose?
Yeah, so one thing there was he said that the attack only benefited the Tory party and their political associates. The polls don't bear that out, actually, and they say that the Tories haven't benefited from this Manchester attack. So factually, he's kind of wrong there. But what you'll also see there is it's a common thread of conspiracy theory to say cui bono on the thing, who benefits. So whenever you're confronted with an event, you look at who benefits, and then you say, well, maybe they were the people behind the event itself. Now, of course, the state will benefit from terrorism in terms of the exercising of its powers and increasing its powers. The state usually benefits from just about every kind of major event. That's the nature of a state. It has power, it has authority, it has resources. So it doesn't follow necessarily that just because a state benefits, it means that the state concerned was behind the attack. So there's a kind of logical problem there. His clip actually went on to bring out another part of the conspiracy theory toolbox, which is numerology. So he pointed out that the number 33 appears in a significant number of places in Manchester. So to him, that was compelling evidence.
Also, the number 22 appears quite a few times.
Well, there you go. So... case closed. The other woman was, it showed it at one remove because she involves herself in just reading these conspiracy theory blogs and YouTube and watching these YouTube videos. She's then duplicating it herself and kind of dipping her toe in the water, and she's making even less sense because it's happening at one remove than the people that make the actual clips where they analyze footage and things like this. What I would describe these two clips as is, one, they're not worth taking seriously, but they fill the space which is created by the fact that we know that the mainstream media on occasion misleads the public or doesn't report fully all of the sides of an event, all the sides of a story. And we also know certainly that governments also mislead or deceive the public. So they enter into that space and say, once you've got to that point where you say, oh yeah, government lies, yeah, can't trust the BBC, can't trust the New York Times, can't trust CNN, oh, I wonder who might tell me the truth. And then these guys pop up and say, well, here's the truth. Here's the truth they don't want you to know. It's to me a little like those ads for magic pills where they say things like, this is the pill that doctors don't want you to know about. You know, this is the miracle pill that the whole of the medical bureaucracy doesn't want you to know about that will cure just about every disease for like send off £10 to a PO box. So these guys fit there. We can actually go from the first one, which is governments and the media often deceive, mislead or lie, and we can also move on then to what we should be doing, which is to carefully look at evidence and carefully look at the information ourselves or find trusted sources who do that. Neither of those clips is doing that.
No, it's all conjecture, isn't it? And you know, there's 101 of those conspiracies. I mean, to be fair though, when it first happened last week, there were certain things that one would expect. The individual, the terrorist, was known to the intelligence services, which he was. The usual other thing would be that some form of ID would be found, and it was, but not as poignant as maybe a passport that's made its way through a tower in Inferno. So there were certain consistencies, and of course these little elements really do fuel the fire for the likes of these over-the-top conspiracies, which are not really explaining anything new. If anyone was to look at the footage or to come across the same information, it may occur to you, but you wouldn't necessarily rush out and do a video on it.
Can we move on now to sort of patching it together with some actual factual information? So this is what we've discovered in the past week about Salman Abedi and his associates and his entanglements. So should we start with the first one, which is very damaging to this kind of conservative refrain that we often hear when there's one of these attacks, and that is to point a finger at the wider Muslim community and say, why aren't the Muslim community warning the authorities, warning the police, warning the security services about these kinds of individuals? So perhaps we start with that, because in the Abedi case, they did warn the authorities.
Five people within the community in which he lived in had contacted the authorities and actually warned them and said, you know, this guy is going around, he's got sympathy for, you know, suicide bombers. You may need to keep an eye on this. But what was it that the intelligence services had deemed him not a credible threat?
Peripheral, they said.
Yeah.
Can I just document that? I found a sixth one, which is even more damning. So right. There are six. I don't know if you're aware of the sixth one. The sixth one is the killer blow, which some of our listeners might not have heard. Okay, the first one. He was reported on an anti-terrorism hotline run by the British government. Why? Because he told his friends that being a suicide bomber was okay. Right. Secondly, a community worker who knew Abedi had been worried he was supporting terrorism and had expressed the view that being a suicide bomber was okay, so he also contacted the authorities. The Didsbury Mosque, which Abedi had attended, contacted the Prevent program about him. And two people who knew him at college made calls about him to the authorities, the BBC added there. Now, the sixth one is the most interesting. Are you ready?
Granted.
The FBI warned MI5 in January that the Manchester bomber was planning an attack on Britain.
And when was this shared with... The FBI informed the British intelligence, did they?
Indeed.
When was this?
January.
January?
Yes.
That... Wow. And they did nothing.
According to a security source, the FBI told MI5 that Abedi was part of a North African Islamic State cell plotting to strike a political target in the UK. The information came from a US investigation into Abedi and his links to terrorist groups in Libya. Mail on Sunday has also been told US security services put him on a terror watch list in 2016. Now, to me, you might say, okay, someone dials the hotline, they're from a community center, do the police follow it up? We're having a struggle, we don't have the resources. But when the FBI contact you, I think that is on a completely different plane.
Well, you would have thought that the person receiving the phone call from the FBI probably would have, should have, sat up and taken notice.
Now, following this US tip-off, Abedi and other members of the gang were scrutinised by MI5. It was thought at the time that Abedi was planning to assassinate a political figure, but nothing came of the investigation. And here's the mail. Tragically, he slipped down the pecking order of targets.
Ignored. Or, you see, then the conspiracy theorists out there would be saying, well, maybe this was a purposeful act on the intelligence services.
Well, this would be the next part,
right,
which we'll now investigate. This is the statement that Abedi was known to the intelligence services. Now, there was a very famous case, actually, with Karl... Remember Karl Rove?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he had a court case, and he was asked as part of the case, do you know X? Was it another person?
Hmm.
And Karl Rove said, could you define no?
Yeah, plausible deniability.
Now, let's move on.
Kind of.
The next piece of evidence, this is a very important story that came out on Middle East Eye. The headline says enough, actually. Sorted, in quotes, by MI5, how UK government sent British Libyans to fight Gaddafi.
Right, so now you was explaining this to me the other day, and I didn't know about this. This is quite a fascinating element of this. So, yeah, explain this.
Now, what we have to understand now, and there's another part of this story which will also be debunked. So the first statement we debunked, the first notion, was that Muslims don't do enough, you know, to draw attention of the authorities to Muslims who may have become radicalized. In this case, that is not the failing. The failing was to act on the warnings, even though one warning came from the FBI who'd placed this individual on a watch list. Now, the second part is, what does it mean to know someone? So what does it mean when the British intelligence services know Abedi or his family? Now, the strap line here. Fighters say government operated open door policy, allowing them to join rebels as authorities investigate background of Manchester bomber. First, we have to rewind a little, because in the early 2000s, relations between Britain and Libya, which had been damaged by the Lockerbie bombing and the assassination of Yvonne Fletcher outside the Libyan embassy, they were reset when Tony Blair had a meeting with Gaddafi out in the desert there.
Yes. I was just going to say that and when he came back, he got a bit of a stick for it, but he was there justifying it, wasn't it?
Well, shortly after that visit, that meeting by Tony Blair, Royal Dutch Shell concluded a £500 million deal with the Libyans for oil production. Now, I found something even more interesting about that meeting, which may interest you and our listeners, and that is that Royal Dutch Shell actually drafted the letter that Tony Blair sent to the Libyan, sent to Gaddafi. So he used their language in his official communication to them. So that gives you an idea there of the intimate intertwining of politics, of government, and big business. But what happened later was it went sour. During the period when we were friends with Gaddafi again, people like Abedi and his family, MI5 knew that they were in Britain. They belonged to this organization called LIFG, that is Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and they were a kind of Muslim resistance. Many of them had been involved with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and had then returned to Libya and tried to carry on that fight. They'd been chased out of the country, and many of them had settled in England, and they were known to MI5. And during that period, when we were friends again, we cracked down on them. So some of them were under control orders. They couldn't go out. They couldn't socialize. They were under that kind of regime. Once regime change was put back on the menu, 2010, I believe. Yeah, things changed then. MI5 went back to these useful idiots and gave them their passports back. So they literally took people off control orders and then handed out passports. So these guys began flying off to Libya to be part of the revolution, the coup against Gaddafi. And Abedi's family, his father, and some of his brothers, they went out there to fight. Now, Abedi himself doesn't seem to have done any fighting because he was a little too young. But as you pointed out, he was free to travel to Syria, he was free to travel to Libya, and he appears to have become more radicalized by these trips.
Isn't it thought that he flew back into the country literally a few days before the attack?
That is correct. I've just received a comment here.
Okay.
That there's some background noise on the show that's making it very hard to listen.
Yeah, I said at the beginning that your microphone is making a lot of noise.
Oh dear.
So,
well, this person suggested that it sounds like a problem at your end, not mine.
Okay. That may be the case.
I do hear like we're in an aircraft hangar on the side of a mountain that's kind of...
Yeah, that's... see, when I turn your channel down, it's gone. So, unless it's an input. I mean, we could play a bit of music and see if we can have a quick look, sort it out.
Okay, I think that would be a good idea.
Okay, if I can find something to play.
Habitual voyeur of what is known as a morning suit can be avoided if you take a route straight through what is known as John Scott Brewer's group. He gets intimidated by the dirty pigeons. They love a bit of him. Who was that gut lord marching? You should cut down on your pork life, mate. Get some exercise. Except on Wednesdays when I get rudely awakened by the dustman. I put my trousers on, have a cup of tea, and I think about leaving the house. I feed the pigeons, I sometimes feed the sparrows too. It gives me a sense of enormous well-being. And then I'm happy for the rest of the day. Safe in the knowledge there will always be a bit of my heart devoted to it.
Hello, Jay. Can you hear us all right? Hello, Jay. Can you hear us? No, we're having sound issues. This is fun. So, where is it, that one? So, we need to go over to there. We need to come down to there. Do that. And, yeah, so... Jay? Hello? Can you hear us, Jay? Yeah, we're not getting any sound out at the moment. So we'll play another piece of music and we'll carry on feeling about. No. Jay, can you hear us? Still nothing.
He's calling.
Oh, is he calling?
Just leave.
Ah, there you are. Hello.
Oh.
That's gone now.
Hmm.
That noise. It wasn't at this end. I think it was at your end, Jay. Because we've got the same setup here now. Oh, you got to love.
I truly have. No idea. I'm very sorry about that. Maybe we need to get together and do some testing now the studio has been moved.
Yeah, well, we're having technical issues here anyway, because we've got three sound cards and various things keep swishing around. But the sound noise coming from your channel is similar to the sound noise that I was getting when we talk, you know, on my system at home. So...
Maybe it's time to retire my karaoke £2 microphone and invest in, as we said, upgrade to the Bingo Master version.
The Bingo. Is that your phone going now?
Oh, sorry.
That's like R2D2.
Yeah, it's like you've got your little robot accompanying you.
We are now communicating on my smartphone in the attic. It's also pointed out that there may have been some fan noise during tonight's show because... we're into the Taiwan summer, and although it's after midnight, it's about 30 degrees here.
Ooh, a bit close then, is it?
It's astonishing.
Right, so you're on your phone now?
Yes.
Right, well, there's no sound, as in no noise going on, so that's an interesting...
Okay, maybe we switch to this method.
Well,
coming shows.
Well, until we get the whatever issue is ailing us, we'll sort it out. But anyway... Sorry about that, everyone listening, about having technical issues. That can happen sometimes. So, where were we? We were just about to kind of boil down into the idea of these people being given back their passports and then being allowed to travel. These would be the people who were basically wanting to fight against Libya, right? Is that correct?
That's right. Now, what had happened was one of these people that flew out said he was asked by an intelligence officer from MI5, are you willing to go into battle? And while I took time to find an answer, he turned and told me the British government have no problem with people fighting against Gaddafi. And then it cites another example here. He was told this individual speak. This is not a Bedi, obviously. This is people who were involved in the same groups. And they did know a Bedi, but they're talking about their experiences. And they're not all quoted by name, obviously, because they don't want their names out there. He said he was returning. He was traveling back to Libya in May 2011. He was approached by two counter-terrorism police officers in the departure lounge who told him that if he was going to fight, he would be committing a crime. But after providing them with the name and phone number of the MI5 officer he had spoken to previously, and following a quick phone call, he was waved through. As he waited to board the plane, he said the same MI5 officer called him to tell him that he had, quote, sorted it out. The government didn't put any obstacles in the way of people going to Libya, he told MEE Middle East Eye. The vast majority of UK guys were in their late 20s. There were some 18 and 19. The majority who went from here were from Manchester.
Interesting.
So what we're finding here is that to know someone doesn't mean to be on the outside and to simply be placing them under surveillance. What it means here is to be managing them.
Handling them.
Handling them in their parlance. Absolutely. So what had happened was, if you look into this this LIFG, throughout, even now, if you go on the Home Office website and look through a list of prescribed terrorist organizations, the LIFG is still there, listed. It's been banned since 2005. And it states on this government PDF, the LIFG seeks to replace the current Libyan regime with a hardline Islamic State. The group is also part of the wider global Islamist extremist movement as inspired by Al-Qaeda. The group has mounted several operations inside Libya, including a 1996 attempt to assassinate Gaddafi. So MI5 knew about this group's presence, and it amounted to around something like 20 people, it appears. They'd formed some kind of small community in Whalley Range in Manchester. And MI5 had facilitated or green-lighted them to be able to travel to the region, and MI5 knew all about them. So you have to ask yourself, here we see that the security services aren't really keeping the British people safe. What they're doing is they're playing their game, their geopolitical game. And in this case, what it meant, it's blown up in their faces literally now, but what it meant was just letting terrorists live and plan their operations from the UK and then take them overseas. But in Abedi's case, one of them has launched his own operation on UK soil. So that clarifies what it means to know Abedi. They knew him very well. His family were intimately linked with the LIFG. Now, the next part would be, did Abedi act alone? So if you read the newspapers, and The Guardian carried this story, what's your perspective there in terms of did he act alone, yes or no?
Well, there's been an interesting few opinions on this in the sense that I've come across where they're saying that the standard of the bomb, not the kind of bomb that someone would generally knock up at home as an amateur after getting the instructions off the internet, and actually I've heard from a couple of places that for some reason, Germany is being mentioned in relation to that, how accurate that is. I would suggest with any of these operations, I would think there has to be a team, a cell, as they would call it, a terror cell. At one point, they were suggesting that he was part of a terror cell, and then yesterday, they were saying, oh, no, he made the bomb himself. So, yeah, at the moment, I would assume that he could be part of a terror cell, but anyway.
So here, we went through what the meaning of the word no, and it's kind of many permutations. Now we see the meaning of the word alone.
Mm.
Alone here, in government speak, means he carried out the attack alone.
Yeah.
That's what it means. But if we follow that kind of logic, that would be like saying, I don't know, because Neil Armstrong opened the door of the lunar module and stepped onto the surface of the moon by himself. He went to the moon alone.
But he
was leaving out an awful lot in terms of the connections there and his associates. As I said, the LIFG, there was numbered something like 20 at least in Manchester, and Abedi was a part of that group. For a start, MI5 could simply go out and arrest every member of the LIFG that's in the UK. They've made 12 to 13 arrests so far, but most of them have been released, right? If they're members of a prescribed organization, I'm not a lawyer here, but that in itself may be a crime, so they could be prosecuted. The problem for MI5 is if you put these guys in a courtroom, what are they going to say?
Well, this is interesting because there's, you know, this is when these people find themselves not in a situation to talk, are they?
We don't have the resources that the US does to kind of put these people out of the reach of the media and the public. What I think we may see is that a number of these individuals may, for whatever reason, a little like MPs like to, you know, retire and spend more time with their families, these individuals may discover a sudden urge to relocate. So I think some of them will be leaving the UK in the very near future.
Hmm. Usually with the MPs wanting to spend more time with their families, that's just after they've been found out that they've been having an affair.
Yeah. So another angry voice, Thomas Clark, so there's this blogger called Another Angry Voice. Apparently he's getting more viral traffic on Facebook than The Guardian or the BBC. I think you're familiar with his site, aren't you? He's very well known for the distinctive graphics that he makes that people share on Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah, so
he's got a list of questions that arise from this, Dave. So I'll just give you a few of them.
Kind of.
So, was the Home Office made aware of this FBI tip that Abedi was planning a terrorist attack? Why was the investigation dropped? Who signed off on the investigation being dropped? What was the justification for the investigation being dropped? Have any other investigations been dropped after tip-offs from the FBI? How did someone who was so recently under investigation as a terrorism suspect, how was he allowed to pass through a UK airport on the way back from Libya? And the French government say they have evidence he was also in Syria. What evidence does the UK have about his involvement with Islamic State in Syria? And was Abedi given special dispensation by the UK secret services to travel to Libya to fight in the civil war there? And how many British Libyans were given that kind of dispensation? These are all the questions that an MP should be standing up at Westminster and asking of the government here. Unfortunately, as you played at the start of the show, instead it's been more of this pointing at one another and accusing one another of speaking out of turn, rather than actually investigating what has gone on here. There is an inquiry being launched into the Abedi entanglement with MI5, and I'll invite you in true British fashion to guess who's leading that inquiry.
Who's leading the inquiry into his connections?
Who's leading the inquiry into possible flaws in the MI5 handling of Salman Abedi? Have a guess who's leading the inquiry.
Well, I just assumed that the very same intelligence services just basically being investigated. So MI5?
MI5 are now going to be the impartial investigators. So they examine their role and determine how to exonerate themselves. This attack, when you read into these connections, we also have this burning blogger of Bedlam guy that we can move on to. He's got a very good article, even written a book about the UK government relationship with Libya and the intelligence services. But, I lost my thread there of what I was going to say.
Oh, right, okay. Well, I've not read that, so you sent us a link to it, and it does actually look quite comprehensive, some of the information that I have read on there. And the book. So, yeah, the guy's obviously a mad researcher. Have you got your...
Yeah, he says he turned away from kind of career-oriented stuff and realised that no one was going to publish what he was interested in, so he would just write it anyway, and his book is free on his blog, and I did listen to a podcast with him. He's very well acquainted with the circumstances of the coup in Libya. One thing he did point out, he contrasted the coup by which Gaddafi came to power, which was famously, there was practically no violence involved. when Gaddafi came to power in 1969, I believe it was. But, of course, the 2011 coup was huge carnage, NATO-led, and with all these jihadis kind of going in. It was a complete bloodbath. So he did kind of point that out.
Yeah, there was.
I don't know if you want to talk to him. What I was interested in was perhaps bringing him onto the show. In a future episode, I think he'd probably be up for that.
Right, yeah, that'd be fascinating to hear what the guy says, actually, when it comes to like this research stuff. What was you mentioned he has a book. What was the book he's written? What was that on? Similar stuff.
That's just the Libya conspiracy. It's a book all about this relationship between the UK intelligence services and Libya, stretching kind of way back, and why there's so much interest. As I did say there, we think of the security services as being rather like policemen, and their job being, as they like to say, to keep the nation safe. But one part of what they're doing is this dirty tricks and the use of extremists to further particular policy aims they may have in other countries. Oh, now I remember my thread. I was going to basically summarize the word blowback there.
Okay.
I don't know if it's really entered public speak in the UK or not. It's very much an American term. But do you hear people talking about blowback?
No, I've not heard that particular phrase used. Repercussions, yeah, so that kind of thing, isn't it?
Sorry.
No, go on.
Yeah, so actually, not every consequence of a policy is blowback. Not everyone. The tight definition, the strict definition, is when covert action leads to some devastating consequences.
Right.
So here, this MI5 intelligence operation, this management of the Libyan fighting group, appears to have resulted in blowback of a most serious nature. Doesn't seem that it's getting much play in the UK media. Sometimes it's easier and it's preferable for the government and the security services to focus instead on kind of the human dimensions. So no doubt in the coming days, with all the funerals and the life stories and the tragedies as a result of this attack, the focus will be placed upon them. And some of these harder questions are maybe going to just fade away.
And these questions that he's brought up, would it be Amber Rudd that would be the one to answer these?
Or Amber Rudd, but also Theresa May was Home Secretary at the time. So the question would be, it would be one of those trying to trap them in a double bind. Either she knew, so she has to say, I knew, or she didn't know, so you'd have to say, well, why didn't you know? You were the person responsible. So it's not an easy answer for Theresa May. It also does show why, perhaps, not been so easy for the Tories to make political capital out of this attack, as our conspiracy theorists kind of hinted. One, because the Tory cuts to the police force have really made it difficult for them to point at Labour and say that Labour are not going to keep the country safe, when it's very clear, and there are numerous clips on social media of members of the Police Federation denouncing and hissing and booing Theresa May and Amber Rudd for what they've done to the policing service. They basically feel that they're under attack and that the service is disintegrating. We did play a clip on a previous show. So I think that has sunk into the public understanding, and that makes it difficult for this strong and stable message to really carry much weight at the moment.
Yeah, she has actually tried recently to say that about the strong and stable, I'm the one that's going to keep the UK safe. But obviously, if she was then Home Secretary during this period of time, 7 years, up to 7 years ago, she would have resided over all this, surely. And so you would have assumed, as the minister of that department, she would have surely known about this.
It's also one of these examples where the political administration is changing. There was the handover from New Labour to the Conservative government. So there was the handover from Gordon Brown to David Cameron. But this MI5, MI6 operations, there was continuity there, because they began in 2004 after Blair met Gaddafi in the desert, and then they basically have carried on until they were kind of reversed in short order, and then the jihadis were sent out there to do their worst during the coup. So it's been a common thread. This is the stuff that you can go and vote next Thursday, but your vote won't do a lot to influence the direction of this kind of policy making, which happens in the shadows.
This is, didn't we mentioned this recently, where we were talking about the deep state and that these civil servants who work in the machinery that are basically there for longer than the leaders, these are the people that end up having the most influence. So we're talking about that, really, aren't we? Like the could it be as bold as be known as the deep state?
I think very much so. We also do see that there are close links between the intelligence services and many of the major British corporations. We did talk about Mr. Ethical on a previous show.
Yes.
HSBC have strong links with the BBC, with the Guardian, with the Conservative Party, and also with the intelligence services. So this kind of crossover at the very, very top of British society between the business world, the political world, the media world, and this the world of the intelligence services. So, as you say, governments come and go. Parties have their time in power, and then they have their time in opposition. But this kind of stuff and these appointments, they're the ones working away to the consistent kind of long-term goals, which we never, as a public, get to vote on. We're always told that what's coming up is just this next 5 years. We don't have a input into what the long-range kind of strategic planning is.
Yeah.
And you might say, well, these are the experts, let them take care of it. What does the average person know about what to do in the Middle East or about how to play these geopolitical games? And that may be true. But should the whole thing happen with no accountability whatsoever, and when there's a huge failure, as this Manchester attack represents, should there be no clear out? No one's head on the chopping block? Well, maybe that's not the right imagery to use, but you understand my point. Why is no one really going to be held responsible for this? In British fashion, it always seems to be there's a section of the society who are simply too privileged, too wealthy, or too posh to ever be subjected to the horror, you know, the indignity of being dragged into a courtroom and put on public trial for what they've done. As you said, they can serve out their time in government and then either join the board of one of these companies or just go and live in their little house in the Cotswolds and enjoy their retirement. But there's never much in the way of accountability, is there?
No, and it, as it's been seen for quite a few years, it's like a revolving door between the policymakers and the CEOs and the committees of various companies. Now, you mentioned there about chopping block. I thought that was a perfect segue into the, was it Kathy
Griffin.
Oh, dear. Now, I did actually hear about this story a few days ago before she made the apology, and there was, I saw it. I mean, I take it you've seen the pictures. Kathy Griffin. And,
I didn't actually look at the pictures because I don't usually, as a rule, find American kind of satire or political humour that engaging, so I never follow this stuff. People might enjoy Saturday Night Live or the
Today
Show, but I don't really see what's in it. What interesting. Do you have the clip to play of the apology?
I do indeed.
I sincerely apologize. I am just now seeing the reaction of these images. I'm a comic. I cross the line. I move the line, then I cross it. I went way too far. The image is too disturbing. I understand how it offends people. It wasn't funny. I get it. I've made a lot of mistakes in my career. I will continue. I asked your forgiveness, taking down the image, going to ask the photographer to take down the image, and I beg for your forgiveness. I went too far. I made a mistake, and I was wrong.
Right, so just in case the listeners are not familiar with what... This is an American comedian. And what she did was depict herself, seemingly standing up like a terrorist, holding a decapitated Donald Trump head, complete with fake blood. Right? Now, when you looked at this, generally it's quite sick. It's not funny. It's not even dark or black humour. It's depicting your president to be decapitated like a terrorist, right? Unbelievable.
Yeah, I just found that appalling. But the other instructive part of that was that she makes this reference having crossed the line. Well, I think the line was rather clearly drawn there. But the whole point of this distinction usually in American life is that liberals, and she's a liberal, they believe that what distinguishes liberals from the right is the fact that they draw the line in a different place. And they don't, you know, they're not as barbarous as their right-wing opponents. And they do value dignity, or they value, you know, people's feelings more than these heartless people on the right. So it just kind of showed there. There's actually no distinction. I think what's happened in the U.S., having spent some time there, is we talked about the political journey today, didn't we? And you thought that was kind of a good point to talk about the journey various politicians have been on. Now, I think what's happening in American life is that because of these culture wars, individuals don't really go on a political journey anymore. What you'll find in the U.S. is if you go to California, you have lots of liberal neighborhoods, or you go to Portland and you'll find you have lots of liberal people there. You go to the South, the Southern states, and you'll find lots of Republicans. And it's become that your political affiliation is more of a cultural thing than being the outcome of any deep political journey. So I think Kathy Griffin there is kind of evidence for my little theory, because she's clearly incredibly naive and she doesn't really hold to any of those high principles. That was just a truly an awful thing to do, I believe.
Yeah, whether she was trying to go for the shock value. I came across it while watching Fox, and Fox was showing you the pictures and stuff. And there's nothing funny about it. And to be honest, I mean, wouldn't that be seen as hate speech?
I'm not so sure, but it's going to be hard for her to carry on, and it has been a career ender. She's been fired.
Oh, fired from where was it she was working?
Saturday Night Live, I think it is.
Ah,
or some comedy
okay.
show. And then the other thing that I thought is maybe she can team up with the Rachel DeLezel, the kind of black-white woman. Maybe they could form a double act. They could call themselves the two least popular women in America.
Well, yeah, she certainly is at the moment after that stunt.
Well, there's another DeLezel story this week, is she was due to attend a literary festival. I think it began with a P. It was either Philadelphia or Pennsylvania. So it was one of these two places. And a huge segment of the people that have been invited to participate in this literary festival have basically said, if you book her, you can't book us. So she's now been, I like this verb, disinvited.
Disinvited.
And she's apparently applied for more than 100 jobs, and she can't get a job. The only offers she's had were reality TV, I think it was, and pornography.
Porn.
As one of my friends pointed out, she's finding out how hard it is for a black person in America to get a job.
You wanted to get closer to the experience. There it is.
Well, I did say on the Twitter there, I said, times sure are hard for pretend black folks.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, we'll have to dig out the video of her parents telling her to go and seek mental health. You know.
Well, I wouldn't like her to kind of descend into doing any harm to herself, but I really don't believe that she's someone who should be offered too much of a platform for what she's doing. Partly, actually, to protect her from the reaction, because she doesn't seem to have that part of the personality or that part of the brain that tells you to back off. A little like Katie Hopkins, she's not someone to retire, even though she's become effectively notorious. She still doesn't see that she's done anything wrong. So I believe that the best way to kind of cool her down is that she doesn't receive too much exposure and she doesn't receive too much attention. I believe that would benefit her. As a narcissistic personality, she's not going to agree, is she? It's up to people from the outside to kind of be intervening with her. But I certainly don't wish her any harm. I'm just glad to see that she's not going to be able to be used as a kind of cheap publicity stunt on the parts of these events. The people organising that event should have known better. It's backfired. They thought it was a wheeze and would boost what they were doing. Actually, it threatened to destroy what they were doing, so kind of behind that.
Right. Would there be anything else you would like to add, Jay, as it's now speedily the end of the show at 6 o'clock?
I'd like to say sorry if we had some technical problems, and as Dave said, the station is moving studio, and maybe I bear some personal responsibility for my pathetic quality microphone. So I hope that it did not seriously impair people's enjoyment of the show, and that people will forgive the occasional technical lapses. We're not the BBC, we're not the CNN, but hopefully people will enjoy the content regardless. But we will work together to try and improve the technical side. And if you join us on episode 20, hopefully it will be plain sailing.
Which is vote for general election day, man.
Yeah, it will be our election special.
Dun, dun, dun. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jay.
Thank you, Dave.
And thank you to all you out there listening. Much appreciated. And we shall speak to you next week. One would trust.